Greeting and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite anyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Ron Garan. Ron is a retired NASA astronaut who logged 178 days in space and 71 million miles in orbit. He served aboard the space shuttle Discovery and the International Space Station, and later was a long-term resident of the International Space Station, where he lived and worked with U.S. and Russian crewmates. He left NASA in 2013, but not before becoming the first person ever to give a TED Talk from space. Today, Ron applies three-dimensional thinking, or the orbital perspective, to long-term global problem solving, working in the areas primarily in sustainable development, a peaceful planet, to combat world hunger, thirst, and poverty. As a founder of Mana Energy Foundation, a nonprofit social enterprise incubator, Ron helps address the developing world's need for fresh water, renewable energy, and access to communications. Without further ado, please welcome Ron Garan as he talks about the orbital perspective, lessons from the big picture from a journey of 71 million miles. Thank you.
I want to start out our talk today with a discussion of one specific image. I want to talk about NASA image designation AS8-14-2383. This image changed my life, and it's changed your life. In fact, I think it has changed the whole course of human history. You know, images have the ability to change perspective. They have the ability to change the way we see ourselves. And there's probably no better image. No image has done more to change the way we see ourselves than NASA image AS8-14-2383, more commonly known as Earthrise. And Earthrise, the story of Earthrise begins on a winter morning on December 21st, 1968, at the Kennedy Space Center, Florida. Atop the tallest, heaviest, and most powerful rocket ever built, the Saturn V sat Apollo 8 with its three astronaut crew, Commander Frank Borman, Command Module Pilot Jim Lovell, and Lunar Module Pilot Bill Anders. The aim of the mission, to be the first spacecraft, the first manned spacecraft, to not only leave the Earth, not only leave Earth orbit, but successfully reach the moon and complete an entire orbit around it, and of course, safely return to Earth. 3 days later, on December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1968, when Apollo 8 came out from behind the moon for its fourth pass, the crew witnessed Earthrise. Commander Frank Borman saw the Earth emerging from behind the lunar horizon and called in excitement to the others, taking a black and white photo as he did so. In the ensuing scramble, Bill Anders took the more famous photo. It was all captured on the flight recorder. I hope it is.
Oh my God, look at that picture over there. There's the Earth coming up. Wow, that pretty. Hey, don't take that, it's not scheduled. You got a color film, Jim? Hand me a roll of color quick.
Oh man, that's great.
Where is it? Quick.
Thank you. I wonder if they knew what was happening, if they knew the significance of that moment. They became the first humans to see Earth as a whole planet and the first to capture it for the rest of us. Frank Borman, the commander, later recalled the moment. It was the most beautiful, heart-catching sight of my life, one that sent a torrent of nostalgia and sheer homesickness surging through me. Some say Earthrise is the most important photo ever taken. Ironically, taking photographs of Earth are hardly listed at all in the official NASA mission plans. They are put in a miscellaneous category labeled target of opportunity and given the lowest priority. Yet Earthrise has been credited with inspiring the first Earth Day in 1970 and was selected as the first of Life magazine's 100 photographs that changed the world. It could be the most influential environmental photograph ever taken. Bill Anders, after being asked about the photo, summed it up beautifully. We came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing is that we discovered Earth. This image revolutionized how we see the world, how we see ourselves. At its simplest message, one planet, one people, traveling together toward one common future. I would argue that this image changed the course of human history for the better. 2001 Space Odyssey author Arthur C. Clarke summed up its significance this way. The world that existed before Christmas 1968 has passed away as irrevocably as the Earth-centered universe of the Middle Ages. The second Copernican Revolution is upon us, and with it, perhaps the second Renaissance. Many of the children born on the day that Apollo 8 splashed down may live to become citizens of the United Planets. Apollo 8 came at the end of 1968, a year that had seen much strife in the United States and most of the world, a year that saw political assassinations and massive unrest in the streets of Europe and America. Yet Time magazine chose the crew of Apollo 8 as their men of the year in 1968. Recognizing them as the people who most influenced events. One of those assassinations was Martin Luther King. Precisely 1 year before the Apollo astronauts hurtled through space on their voyage to the moon, Dr. King gave a sermon, the Christmas Sermon on Peace, which gives words to what Earthrise evoked.
It really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny, and whatever affects one directly,
yes, sir,
affects all indirectly. We aren't going to have peace on earth until we recognize this basic fact of the interrelated structure of all reality.
The interrelated structure of all reality. So this is not a philosophy or a cliche. This is the reality of the world that we live in. This is a fact. So I want to invite you on a journey to space and back. My first journey to space began in 2008. I awoke on the morning of May 31st, like any other morning, but as I awakened into full consciousness at quarantine at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, the weight of this important day started to sink in. Sitting at breakfast with my crewmates, I thought to myself, this is my last day on Earth for a while. This journey to the launch pad began almost four decades earlier. One of my most vivid childhood memories, and the first moment I realized I wanted to be an astronaut, was July 20th, 1969. It was that day where I, as a young boy, along with millions and millions of people around the world, watched those first footsteps on the moon. I don't think I would have been able to put it in these words at the time, but at some level I realized that humanity had just become a different species. We were no longer a species confined to our planet, and I wanted to be a part of that group of people that stepped off the planet and was able to look back upon ourselves. A few hours after that Florida wake-up, I remember leaving the crew quarters, boarding the Astro van, and waving to everybody as we stepped out. Initially, we had this big convoy of vehicles taking us to the launch pad, but one by one, the vehicles peeled off, leaving only the Astro van. We all took turns climbing through the hatch and into the spacecraft, and after we were all strapped in, I had a little bit of time to think. There I was sitting on 4.5 million pounds of explosives. Well, actually, I was strapped to Space Shuttle Discovery, which was strapped to 4.5 million pounds of explosive, and it's one of those wonderful moments that life gives you for self-reflection. The digital clock in the center of Discovery's control panel, right in front of me, counted down to within a minute. As it counted below 10 seconds, I prepared for the main engines to light. At 6 seconds remaining, a low rumble started, which quickly built in intensity.
Affirmative. TLS is go for main engine start.
6 seconds, main engine start. Three coming up.
3, 2, 3 to 100.
Hang on.
Booster ignition.
Auto two.
Monte Kudasai.
I see 3 at 104. I see a command and a roll.
Houston, Discovery, roll program.
I am LVLH.
Roger roll, Discovery.
Houston now controlling the flight of Discovery, a man-made rising star.
Oh, what a view up to say.
The digitals.
At 8.5 minutes after launch, the engines abruptly shut down according to plan. Inside the spacecraft, we all instantly transitioned to having the force of 3 times our weight push us into our seats to being completely weightless. And at this point, I thought we made it, and by which I meant we survived. But I also was acutely aware that my childhood dream of flying in space had just come true. A little over an hour after launch, when we were all safely in orbit, I was finally able to unstrap and attempt flying around in zero gravity for the first time. Weightlessness was wonderful, and I was surprised at how natural it felt. On that first day in space, the most spectacular moment was when I looked out the window for the first time. When you're able to unstrap, get out of your seat, your tasks are over, and you get to really take a look at our planet, it's just absolutely breathtaking. The first thing that struck me was how thin the atmosphere appeared. In that moment, I was hit with the realization that that paper-thin layer protects every living thing on our planet from perishing in the harshness of space. In contrast to this fragility, you can't help but fall in love with the beauty of our planet. It's a constant dance of light, colors, and motion. And what's really amazing and beautiful is watching the colors change on Earth and watching thunderstorms cast long shadows across the horizon and watch the clouds turn to pink and to red, then gray, and then finally black. And then watch, as we pass into the dark side of the orbit, watch the Earth come alive and watch all the lights of the city, all the evidence of human activity, all of a sudden comes to life, and the Earth becomes like a living, breathing organism. You can see the paparazzi-like flashes of lightning storms, dancing curtains of auroras that feel so close that you can reach out and touch them. It really was beautiful to see. And although this was an incredibly overwhelming visual experience, it was also much, much more. What I experienced in space was an immense gratitude for the opportunity to see the Earth from this vantage point, but also for the gift of the planet that we've all been given. And in some way, I can't explain, being physically detached from the Earth, from the only world I've ever known, made me feel deeply interconnected with everybody on it. So I want to show you another image of the Earth. This is the blue marble. This is one of the most potent symbols of our interconnectedness, this view of our whole Earth from space. Taken 4 years after Earthrise by the crew of Apollo 17 on the way back from the moon, it was one of the most widely distributed images in human history. And it's the last time that we as human beings saw in person the Earth from this perspective. I'm involved with an effort called Planetary Collective. On the 40th anniversary of the Blue Marble photo, we released a documentary called Overview. We expected for the film to be well received in certain circles, but it ended up going viral and getting over 7 million people have viewed the film to date. Being able to see the Earth from this vantage point from space can be a very powerful force to inspire positive action. And for this reason, we have been trying to share this perspective in all the ways we can. In 1987, author Frank White coined the term the overview effect in a book written by the same title. This book explored the idea that astronauts undergo a shift in perspective when entering low Earth orbit and lunar orbit. From this perspective, we see the reality of our lives, that we are part of a living planet. The overview effect is a direct understanding of the truth that we are all inseparably interconnected. It's the overcoming of the limited and false mindset of separation. Our science tells us that we are all descended from bipedal apes that emerged from East Africa about around 200,000 years ago. We migrated into every ecosystem on the planet, deserts, plains, jungles, and even barren glaciers, and finally ventured into space. It was in space that we looked back and saw what we have always been, one single human family with a common origin and now an awareness of the reality of our common future. Our civilization is driven by cooperation. That sphere of cooperation has been expanding throughout history with the development of technology and increasing population and interconnectivity of humankind. We are now at the point where the challenges facing us require thinking, relating, and cooperating on the planetary level. The hard problems facing us cannot be solved at the national level alone. As renowned astronomer Carl Sagan famously said, Molecules don't have passports. This year, on July 21st, NASA released a new blue marble photograph taken by the Discover satellite. What has changed since 1972? What have we done to improve the systems on this planet? What will the blue marble look like in 2050, in 2100? At the request of Carl Sagan, a very different image of our Earth was taken by Voyager 1. The Voyager 1 spacecraft provided us an even broader perspective of the world that we call home. As the spacecraft left our planetary neighborhood for the fringes of the solar system, engineers turned the spacecraft around for one last look at our planet. Voyager 1 was about 4 billion miles away when it captured a portrait of our world that I'm going to show you in a second. Caught in the center of the scattered light rays, Earth appears as a tiny point of light, a fraction of a pixel in size. This image inspired Carl Sagan to address our responsibilities to our Earth and to each other.
The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
So this idea of one human family on a pale blue dot is a wonderful idea, but what does it really mean to us? What does that look like in the real world? I experienced what profound human collaboration looks like on my second mission to space. My second journey to space, where I spent half of 2011 aboard the International Space Station, started with a launch from Kazakhstan on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft. During my 6 months in space, I got into a routine where I would almost say goodnight to the Earth. As it was time to go to bed, I would go to the cupola, which is this windowed observatory on the bottom of the space station. I would just gaze at the Earth for a little while before I went to bed. As I would gaze back at the planet, I would wonder what the world would look like in the next 50 years. How far would we progress in overcoming the challenges facing our planet? As I would take in this incredible scene, I would routinely be hit in the gut with a sobering contradiction between the beauty of our planet on one hand and the unfortunate realities of life on our planet for a significant number of its inhabitants. Those don't have clean water to drink, enough food to eat, the poverty, the conflict, the strife that exists on our planet. And I launched into space with a belief that we have all the technology and all the resources necessary to solve many, if not all, the problems facing our planet. And I spent a good deal of my time earth-gazing, pondering the question, if this is true, why do they still remain? The seeds to that question were planted 3 years earlier on my first space flight. Here we are leaving the airlock on our third spacewalk of that mission. And during the spacewalk, my feet were strapped to the end of the space station's robotic arm. And the arm was flown through a maneuver we called the windshield wiper, which took me across this big arc across the top of the space station and back. And I found myself looking down at the top of this arc at the enormous International Space Station. Below me about 100 feet with the Earth 240 miles below, it was just indescribably a beautiful scene. The sheer beauty of the scene took my breath away, but even more compelling than the beauty was a realization of the tremendous human achievement that the International Space Station represents. It's not only an amazing technological accomplishment, probably the most complex structure ever built, but it's also one of the most amazing examples of international cooperation. As I hung there, looking down at the station against the Earth, I marveled that 15 nations, some of which haven't always been the best of friends, haven't always been on the right sides of the Cold War and the space race, had somehow found a way to work together to overcome their differences and achieve something amazing in space. And I wondered what the world would be like if we could overcome our cultural barriers to collaboration and how many fewer problems we would all face if we could figure out how to have that same level of cooperation here in our interactions on the Earth's surface. I was born in the year that Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space at the height of the Cold War. 50 years, almost to the day, from the very same launch pad that Yuri Gagarin launched from, I launched into space as a fully integrated member of a Russian spacecraft crew with a couple of Russian military officers on a spacecraft called Gagarin. And as we stood there at the base of the rocket that would take us to space, I looked up at the rocket and I saw an American flag. That image was burned into me. You have to understand, for the first 15 years of my adult life, I trained to fight the Russians, our most menacing enemy. Collaboration doesn't mean that we agree on all things. It means we are willing to seek out and find the common ground. We're willing to find those things that we do agree on and use those to build relationships and hopefully a foundation of trust that we can use to start to address the things that we don't agree on. I think when we look back at the International Space Station, an equally important legacy that the space station will leave is the shining example of international cooperation. The need for international cooperation came really clear to me about a month before I returned to Earth on my last mission, when I took this photo that shows an illuminated line snaking across a large landmass for hundreds and hundreds of miles. And I've always been one of these astronauts that say you can't see any borders from space. Apparently I'm wrong, because what this line actually is the man-made border between India and Pakistan, the man-made illuminated border. Seeing this scar on the otherwise beautiful landscape, this man-made barrier to collaboration, clearly visible from space, had a huge effect on me. For the 50 plus years that humans have been flying in space, astronauts and cosmonauts have commented on how beautiful, how tranquil, how peaceful, how fragile our Earth looks from space. It truly is moving to see our planet from space. The point is not that we can look down and see a man-made border between India and Pakistan. The point is that we could look down at that same area and feel empathy for the struggles that all people face. We can look down from our orbital perspective and realize that each and every one of us is riding through the universe together on this spaceship that we call Earth, that we're all interconnected, that we're all in this together, and that we're all family. And even though space exploration started as a competition, it was always viewed as a means for peaceful expansion of human knowledge and cooperation. Even in the early days, the possibility for peaceful cooperation was the goal.
There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind. And its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again.
One of the ways of thinking about the need for peaceful cooperation is likening our planet to a spacecraft. In fact, Buckminster Fuller, the great architect, futurist, and inventor, he invented the geodesic dome, for instance, popularized the term spaceship Earth. From Earth orbit, it becomes apparent that our world really is a spacecraft, and each and every one of us is in space already, right now. And it really makes you wonder about the life support systems on spaceship Earth. One of our goals in spacecraft design is to develop closed life support systems. That is, life support systems that do not require resupply or the addition of other resources. Life support systems that reuse 100% of the resources required. At the moment, Spaceship Earth does not have a closed life support system, which means that we are using up resources faster than they are being replenished. That puts our global society on a trajectory that is unsustainable. And therefore, on our current trajectory, there will come a point when we will run out of the resources we need to sustain life. There is no plan B, as Carl Sagan said, for the foreseeable future, the Earth is where we make our stand. We have to figure this out. You don't have to be in orbit to realize that we live on a planet of finite resources, and we need to do something to reduce the rate that we're using up non-renewable resources. Now, this is not just a way to ensure that future generations have the resources that they need, but it's also good business now. I think businesses today need to find ways to decouple business practices from scarce and constrained resources. Companies that do not take a sustainable business approach and are overly focused on the short term versus the long term are going to be at a massive disadvantage as key resources in the value chain become more and more scarce. I've done a lot of sustainable development work in various areas around the world, and during some of these efforts, I've become frustrated with how we keep trying to address issues such as climate change, poverty, deforestation, access to clean water, biodiversity loss, et cetera, as standalone issues, when in reality, they are symptoms of the underlying root problem. The problem is, is that we don't see ourselves as planetary. So what do I mean when I say planetary, and why planetary and not global? Well, we don't live on a globe. Global is our computer networks, our financial networks, it's abstract lines covering the planet. When astronauts look out the window, we see a living, iridescent biosphere. We don't see the economy. The economy is a subsystem of a society created by a species that is in turn part of the biosphere. That means that our global economy is the wholly owned subsidiary of the biosphere and not the other way around. If we zoom out and take a look at sustainability from the orbital perspective, some things become clear. When we define sustainable development, we can talk about three core areas: society, environment, and economy, sometimes referred to as the triple bottom line. However, these are not equal, but rather nested. When you look out the window of the space station, you see our planet, Earth. You don't see the economy, yet our economy is our primary referent, our primary system, our primary focus. Our social and political organization is based on the idea that everything is a subsidiary of the economy. But our economy and our financial systems are embedded within our human society, which in turn is embedded within the biosphere called Earth. Sustainable development can be summed up this way. We move from thinking economy, society, planet to planet, society, economy. Our society is dependent on our planet, our economy is dependent on society, not the other way around. Since our political and social systems are based on precisely the opposite of that reality, we are living a lie. To be planetary entails including the biosphere and decision-making processes, because we are embedded in our planet and intertwined and dependent on all its life support systems. Sustainable development from the orbital perspective is essentially the reorganization, prioritization of these systems, not out of any ideological or eco-philosophy, but rather because this is the reality that we live in. The reality of the lack of a closed life support system on spaceship Earth is dawning on us much quicker than we ever anticipated. And transitioning to this reality appears risky. But ultimately, the most risky course of action is not to do anything at all. One of the goals in any sustainable and innovative business strategy should be to address risk. Change requires taking on risk. And I want to share with you a story that has shaped every decision I've made concerning risk over the last 25 plus years. And this is a picture of me in my first operational F-16 squadron in Germany. I was a very stereotypical young fighter pilot. I was a little cocky. I tended to think of myself as seemingly indestructible. But on September 13th, 1988, a few months after this picture was taken, I was taken off in a fully loaded F-16 jet fighter on a training mission. Up until this point, I had thousands of takeoffs and landings, and nothing had ever gone wrong until that day. On that day, as I was rolling down the runway in my single seat, single engine F-16, as I got a few feet in the air, I heard a pop followed by a loud explosion that knocked my feet off the rudder pedals and my head back into my seat. As a single engine pilot, I was trained to be acutely aware of my engine parameters. The engine appeared to still be running. At this point, I attempted to make a climbing turn with the goal of hopefully getting to a point where if the engine failed, I could dead stick the jet in for landing. As soon as I started the turn, though, I realized that that was not going to be an option today. I realized that the jet no longer had any usable thrust, and this close to the ground, my only option was to eject. My concern shifted from trying to save the jet to trying to minimize the aftermath of a jet that was about to crash. Now, fighter aircraft have this button called the emergency storage jettison that, if pushed, clears everything off the wings. And I thought for a second to buy some time by jettisoning some weight, but right in front of me was rush hour traffic off the end of the runway. At this point, I was headed straight to a trailer park, and I turned the aircraft a little bit to the left to an area that was less populated. I then saw a wide open area further to the left and attempted to steer the aircraft there. But as I did, the aircraft went out of control and sliced back to the right. At that point, it was very apparent to me that there was no reason for me to stay with the ship, and I reached down and pulled the ejection handle. The realization that there was nothing more I could do probably saved my life, because I ejected about 4 seconds prior to impact and probably less than a second before I would have been out of the ejection envelope. Now, this whole story took considerably longer to tell than it actually happened. The whole story probably occurred in the time frame of about 20 seconds. So you would think that a situation like that would have some kind of effect on me, that it would somehow change my outlook on flying, life, and risk. And for some reason unknown to me, it really did not. What would happen the next day would be the life-changing wake-up call that I just hit the snooze button on the day before. The next day, in the spirit of getting back on the horse, I was leading a formation of four F-16s on a training mission, Taking off first, when I was airborne, I retarded the throttle after afterburner and heard a pop. And I remember thinking to myself, I bet it's always done that, and I just never noticed it before because I'm really being very hypersensitive and aware. But the next thing I heard was the low-speed warning horn come on, indicating that I had another engine malfunction. This time I was a little higher and faster, and there was not rush hour traffic beneath me, so I did hit the emergency storage jettison, but unbeknownst to me, I had a secondary malfunction, and everything on one side of the wing cleared off, and everything on the other wing did not, leaving me in an uncertified asymmetric condition. I ended up landing this one opposite direction just as my number four was getting airborne. And what got my attention was after thousands of uneventful takeoffs, I had two that almost killed me back to back. I wouldn't say I was a daredevil before that, but after that second incident in as many days, I definitely changed. After that, my eyes were opened and I saw risk in a new light. I saw risk as the price to pay for a benefit. I saw an emerging risk-benefit trade-off. This new outlook probably saved my life and carried me through many dangerous periods of my life, from flying in combat during the first Gulf War to being an instructor at the Air Force's Fighter Weapons School, the Air Force's Top Gun School, where over the course of my 3 years there, I attended five memorial services from my friends and colleagues, to flying as an Air Force test pilot, to two space missions and four spacewalks. In all of those environments, in each of those environments, no matter what the situation was, the first thing I did was assess where the safe exit to the situation was. Unlike the young fighter pilot of my youth, I didn't blindly charge into a situation without first answering the question, where's the way out if everything goes south? But before I ever got into a situation where I could possibly need an exit strategy, I first asked myself, was stepping into that situation worth it? Was the potential benefit worth the risk? The answer to that question was sometimes that the potential benefit is so great and the cost of not taking action so high that I was willing to enter a situation knowing I had no way out if things went south. These situations were obviously very rare. I had a couple of those situations in combat where not putting myself at risk would put threaten lives of troops on the ground. Certainly during the space missions, there were times where all we had to go on was the belief that what we were doing was having a tremendous benefit for the world. In order for an individual, an organization, or a corporation to progress, grow, and succeed, some risk must be taken. The safest possible space program is one that never launches anything to space. But what good is that? What NASA does really good is look at a situation and then devote a great deal of time and effort to try and figure out beforehand every possible thing that can go wrong and develop plans that can be enacted to overcome those situations should they occur. What NASA doesn't do so good is knowing when and when not to apply this rigorous risk mitigation strategy. There's a tendency at NASA to apply this strategy across the board. Now, this can lead to lack of flexibility, nimbleness, and lost opportunities when we can't react fast enough to emerging opportunities. You have to have mechanisms in place to capture great ideas and emerging lower risk opportunities and a streamlined path to action. This is an excellent path to innovation, but the most powerful tools that lead to true innovation is collaboration. Collaboration can lead us to solve our toughest and most seemingly intractable problems. Now, although it's fairly easy to identify our lack of global collaboration as an impediment to a better society, I don't want to give the impression that collaboration is easy. It's not. Collaboration usually comes at the expense of building new capabilities in-house. Partnerships can incur high transaction costs, and maintaining relationships takes work. There's also much confusion about what collaboration is and what it means. Collaboration doesn't mean that everybody in a group has to have an equal vote or that any solution has to include all inputs. True collaboration means that different individuals and groups bring together different pieces of the puzzle, and each member contributes something unique and adds value to the group. By engaging stakeholders, whether they are colleagues, suppliers, customers, or even competitors, across stovepipes, departments, industries, and markets, goods, services, and solutions can be created that far exceed the capabilities of those developed in a vacuum. Open collaborations make solutions better through the pooling of resources and information. Working together multiplies cost effectiveness while reducing duplication of effort. It's the only real way to have economies of scale. Perhaps most importantly, collaboration encourages greater accountability, which fosters trust. To take an orbital perspective of collaboration means, rather than viewing society as an arena for self-interested competition, we view it as a complex living system, an organic whole. Collaboration in this sense is characterized by diverse organizations working together systematically towards goals that benefit the entire social body. We need to find ways to all work together towards our common goals. The key challenge is demonstrating how vital and valuable collaboration truly is, despite the real and perceived risks. In addition to its implications for things like research, open, transparent collaboration will be an engine that will fuel tremendous economic growth and help us overcome many of the problems facing our planet. Those individuals and organizations that engage in secretive dealings, corruption, and those that adhere to an exclusively proprietary mindset will see themselves being left behind and will have to adapt, evolve, and take on a much more collaborative mindset in order to keep up with the economic growth that collaboration will bring. Working together, we need to create incentives to share data and resources using the philosophy that a rising tide lifts all boats. Never before in history has it been easier to incorporate the ideas and efforts of people from around the world, regardless of their political ideology, cultural biases, or geographic location. Up until recently, we did not have the technological tools to enable true global collaboration between governments, universities, industries, and citizen scientists. With an orbital perspective, we realized that the internet has become the nerve center of spaceship Earth, connecting and combining discrete points of creativity and progress into unified action. And once we connect to the internet, the 5 billion creative problem-solving minds who are presently not part of the global conversation, we will find solutions we never dreamed of coming from places we never heard of. So how can this be implemented? Through leadership. Let's say that someone here has a great idea on how to increase sustainability, positive social impact, or maybe someone has come up with an idea for a breakthrough innovation. It must be first noted that ideas are highly overrated. And what I mean by that is, while every great accomplishment starts with a great idea, an idea without action is empty. So after carefully calculating the risk and weighing all the aspects of the risk-benefit equation, after evaluating the underlying motivation for a course of action, in order to reap the desired benefits, a decision needs to be made not only to commit to action, but also there has to be a willingness to step outside of our comfort zones. Any worthwhile endeavor requires hard work and dedication, for sure, but it also requires, at times, stepping outside of our comfort zone. It requires stepping outside of the way we've always done things, to look at things from different angles, and to realize that any one of us or any one organization will not have all the pieces of the puzzle. However, it's precisely those people and organizations that truly commit to making a positive change and step outside of their comfort zones, and it's precisely at those moments when they have the courage to embrace new and innovative ideas, approaches, and partnerships, and collaborate across different disciplines, industries, cultures, boundaries, and borders. Those are the ones that affect real change in the world, disruptive change. One of those areas where we can propel disruptive change is in our business practices and our ability to address and solve challenges via the engines of enterprise. Corporate social responsibility has been viewed in the past as a tool that management can use to improve a brand's image. Thankfully, we're moving away from the mindset that CSR is a tool that a company uses to create this or that good, but spends more time, effort, and resources to advertise about the good than the good they've created, than the actual good themselves. Corporate social responsibility from the orbital perspective places creating social and or environmental good as the core business tenet throughout the entire organization, not stuck in a silo. The social, environmental, and ethical aspects of every business decision must be carefully considered, not only because we have a responsibility to do so, but also because of this age of transparency, openness, and with the public that has been empowered to scream from the digital mountaintops when corporations are not playing nice with each other. Not doing so will have a significant negative effect on the bottom line. I think the successful companies of the future will be those that realize that businesses that have a main focus to create social and or environmental good are simply good businesses. And one of the ways that we can propel this positive mindset is to look at our definition of the word home. So in order to illustrate the power of our definition of the word home, I want to share with you a story about my return to Earth after 6 months in space. And when it was time to return after that mission, my two Russian crewmates and I climbed into our Soyuz spacecraft. We put our spacesuits on. We wiggled ourselves into our seat. It's like three guys in the trunk of a car. It's very, very tight. We undocked from the space station. We did a couple of laps around our planet. And as we passed the south tip of South America, we fishtailed our spacecraft around to point our engines backwards. And as we did this, I saw this crescent moon go by my window. And we fired our engines just to enter the atmosphere. And then we had this fiery, violent ride through the atmosphere at 5 miles a second. The parachutes opened. They threw us all over the place. And then eventually went smashing into the ground. And when we hit the ground, we bounced, we rolled, and we flipped over. And now I was in the right seat, and we landed on the right side of the capsule. And so now my window was facing the ground. And out of my window, I saw a rock, a flower, and a blade of grass. And I remember thinking to myself distinctly that I'm home. And what was really interesting about that, and I get choked up every time I say it, is that I was home, but I was in Kazakhstan. And so to me, at that moment, my home was not Houston, Texas, where I live with my family, or New York, where I grew up. My home was Earth. And that definition of home, I think, has a very profound implication for how we do our problem solving on our planet and how we treat us. I just came back from a week in Berlin where I was leading a task force on the refugee situation there. And that's a crisis that, your definition of home has really profound implications to how we deal with that. And so with that, I want to thank everybody here for all that you're doing and all that you will do to help make life on our planet as beautiful as our Earth looks from space. And I also want to leave you with, you don't have to be in orbit to have an orbital perspective, and by working together, we don't have to accept the status quo on our planet. So thank you.
I expressed our deep thanks to Ron Duran for sharing his beautiful perspectives and beautiful video. Thank you so much. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, please line up behind this mic where I'm standing right now. Speak into the mic as we are recording, so we're now open for questions.
My name is John Petrick, and thank you so much. That was just an outstanding presentation.
Thank you.
Very inspirational. Question, have you taken your story to Washington, D.C.? And if so, what has been the response?
Well, the first book signing I did was in Washington, D.C., and it was Book TV. I left NASA 2 years ago, and I left my dream job, the career and the profession that I worked my entire life to achieve, so that I could tell this story, share this perspective, unencumbered by being an employee of the federal government with all the rules and responsibilities of that. And so everything that I've done since then, whether it's writing the book called The Orbital Perspective, the movie we're working on called Orbital, the startups I'm involved with, I've started artwork as well. Everything has the goal of sharing this big picture, long-term collaborative perspective of our planet. To answer your question, I haven't, I sold the book, we're selling books in Washington, D.C. I don't know if any of the politicians are buying them, but I haven't gone to the Hill and given this talk, if that's what you're asking. I'd love to, though.
Okay, this is a question for me. One of the things I was really taken by is in your presentation was the very thin layer of the atmosphere that, as you said, is responsible for all we have here. And then there was a report recently that they estimate that something from the sun blew the atmosphere off the planet.
Mars. Yeah.
Mars, yeah. So can you talk about that in terms of how fragile the planet is? And
yeah, I mean, I started an effort called Fragile Oasis because that, to me, was the first thought I had when I looked back at the planet was how fragile it looked, and that was scary, actually, to see that. And when you look up at the sky, it's the big blue sky. When you think it goes on forever, but when you see it from that vantage point, it's sobering. We need to do everything that we can do to protect it.
Andrew Heaton, San Francisco. Your presentation included a lot of shots of the shuttle, and obviously you were involved in that program. What's NASA got next now that they've shut the shuttle program down?
Right, so there's a number of efforts to develop new spacecraft that will take humans to space. But one of the biggest shifts in strategy, I guess you could say, that NASA has is this desire to turn over, to some extent, human operations in low Earth orbit to commercial activities. So there's a lot of commercial activities that are coming up. They're doing both suborbital and orbital flights, hopefully, in the next, I don't know, three to five years, if everything goes well. And what that does is it frees NASA and the other big government space agencies to do what they're chartered to do in the first place, which is exploration, is to, you know, see what's over the next hill and to leave low Earth orbit and to start to explore the solar system. So it is really exciting times. There's a lot of students in the audience, and I hope that we see some of you on Mars one day and beyond, because I think I'm optimistic that within, I don't want to put a time frame on it, but you know, maybe within the next 10 years or so, maybe a little bit longer, that space flight, at least in low Earth orbit, becomes as commonplace as air flight, as traveling on an airplane. So I think we're on the dawn of a new space era, I think, and it's really exciting.
Yes, hi, Bill Marlow, and my question is, what does it take to kick off collaboration? I mean, we have, on a worldwide basis, we have the United Nations as probably the only visible one that comes to mind. And, you know, are there organizations other than that that are engaged in trying to bring together collaboration on?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we can do to jumpstart collaboration, if you will, is the open sharing of information, is because there's a lot of, you know, stereotypes, there's a lot of false information, but I think given the facts, and when people are exposed to the reality of the world that we live in, and the reality of maybe other groups of people on our planet, I think what the reality of that is, we have so much more in common than those things that separate us. And, you know, we live in a very, very complicated world. Our world has, you know, crime and terrorism and environmental damage and poverty and all these terrible things, but it also has creativity and love and generosity and compassion. And so because we live in such a complicated world, we tend to build a more simplified framework to view the world through. And in doing so, we tend to place groups and countries and people into the cubbyholes of this framework. And when we do, we box ourselves in. We box ourselves in from the potential solutions to our shared problems. And I think the more that we can do to share each other's cultures, to share each other's stories, I think the closer we're going to come together. And, you know, that one slide that we had, you know, every single one of us is descended from the same roughly 2,000 humans in present-day Ethiopia, and we immigrated to every spot on the planet. So we are, in fact, brothers and sisters, and we can't lose that fact. And so, you know, you see a lot of that in the U.S. political discord right now, or the discussions that are going on, where one side will fail to recognize any merit whatsoever in the position of the other side, because if they do that, then that side will gain and we will lose. That's a really counterproductive way to solve problems facing our planet. And I think the more that we understand that we do share common goals, we do share common desires, and we share a common life, I think the better off we'll all be. And that really became apparent in space, not just from looking at the planet, but also in interacting with people around the world. People who live in countries that don't necessarily have relationships with the United States, that are expressing the same level of awe and amazement of what we're doing and sharing their hopes and dreams with us. So, thank you.
Oh, Astronaut Garen, hi. My name's Otis Paul. Thanks very much. The comprehensive collaborative thinking idea is wonderful.
Thank you.
A question is, recently an asteroid went by Earth, within a few weeks, and they discovered some oxygen on it. And some of the news reports said that that gave evidence against the theory of the Big Bang. Does that make sense to you? Can you explain that?
That doesn't make sense to me. There's water in many places in the solar system. There's water on the moon. We just found
I couldn't
flowing
figure
water
it out either. Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. But, I mean, since you brought up an asteroid, going back to that other question, one of the reasons I think we don't collaborate is because the problems that we face seem too big. You know, what could one person possibly do? And using an asteroid as an example, we don't have to do it all. We just have to nudge things a little bit. So if an asteroid was coming towards the Earth and it was big enough that it would wipe out everything on the planet, it would be a massive extinction event on the planet, and we knew about it soon enough, we wouldn't have to send Bruce Willis out there to blow it out of the sky. First of all, that wouldn't work. We just have a lot of little asteroids hitting the Earth. But all we'd have to do is send a small spacecraft with the force of a feather, just give the asteroid a teeny little nudge, and over the course of the many years that it would travel to the Earth, that would equate to a miss distance of 100 or 1,000 miles. So for us individually, when we're thinking about whether we want to make a difference or not, we don't have to solve poverty tomorrow. We just need to make a little nudge. We need to nudge the trajectory of our global society just a little bit, and every one of us has a responsibility to put the trajectory on a little bit better, more positive course. We don't have the responsibility to fix the problem tomorrow. So I think that mindset is another hindrance to collaboration if you think that you need to fix things in the short term tomorrow. So,
Ron, as you mentioned, we have a lot of young people in the audience. Yeah. Can you share a little about your personal background? If you think back when you were, I guess, a junior or senior in high school and where you are now, was there something that gave you the energy to sort of keep pushing through, to believe in yourself, to overcome failure, that drive that got you from like a little teenager here to where you are now? Anything to share there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like I said, July 20th, 1969 was the day I wanted to be an astronaut. And when I was young, people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I would say, well, I want to be an astronaut. And they'd say, oh, that's nice. What do you really want to be? So it was kind of an impossible dream. And, a lot of times the difference between success and failure is razor thin. And it's those folks that pursue their dreams when it's not fun, when you don't think you're going to be successful, when everybody's telling you you're crazy for doing it. Those are the people who tend to achieve their goals. And for me, I was not the greatest student in the world, especially in high school. And part of the reason for that is because I lost that dream for a little while. So when I was in high school, it was after Skylab and it was before the space shuttle. And for some kid in New York, we didn't have a space program. So how could you be an astronaut if there's no space program? And so, but when I went to college, I was taking business because I didn't know what else to do because my dream was gone. But when I was a sophomore in college, they had the first space shuttle mission. And then that dream reawoke inside me. And the next day, literally the next day, I went to my advisor and said, how can I start taking math and science courses? And that, I think that really demonstrates the power of the space program to inspire not only academic excellence, but also to inspire people to pursue courses in math and science and technology. And so I guess the advice is don't give up on your dreams, whatever those dreams are. Find something that you truly love to do and be the very, very best you can be at that.
Well, it looks like you did such a great job. We don't have very many. Well, this one last question here? Okay, we have one more question. Okay, here she comes.
Hi, my name is Sarah Wilhelmy, and I was incredibly inspired by your presentation. I have a two-and-a-half-year-old daughter who said she's going to fly Blue Angels when she gets big, so you're inspiring another generation. I was hoping maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on your experience at the International Space Station, and I just find it so compelling of that kind of microcosm, if you will, of how that collaboration can happen and be effective. So I was curious about some examples of what you achieved there, and then also, what is the future of the International Space Station, and what role does that play as we continue to expand and evolve?
Sure. I mean, not to do a commercial, but the purpose of the book, The Orbital Perspective, one of the main themes of it is to bring the collaboration, the details of the collaboration that built the International Space Station, and bring it down to Earth and put it in the context of our global society. And so in the introduction, you heard that I worked with Russians. I also worked with Europeans and Japanese. And so it is there's control rooms around the world. We have a control room in Moscow and a couple in the U.S., in Canada, in Japan, in Europe. And so it's not just the team in the space station. It's the team around the world. And it really, when we're there, we're a member of one crew that just happens to be citizens of different nations. That the one crew is the overarching thing. And I was there when there was, you know, some political situations going on. There was tension between the U.S. and Russia, and that, you know, there's obviously lots of problems today. And that, you know, that whole complex, both literally and figuratively, rises above, for the most part, those things. Now the politicians try, and the media tries to drag it back down into it. But the reality of it is that we see the bigger picture, again, both literally and figuratively. And you know, there were a lot of cultural differences to overcome. A lot of those had to do with pride and arrogance and lack of knowledge and misunderstanding and language barriers and cultural differences. And we, over a number of years, had to work through all those. And what came out of it is a really strong foundation that hopefully we can use to start to address the things that we don't agree on. But the problem is we tend to do the exact opposite. We tend to take the things that we agree on and use that as a stick to force the things that we don't agree on. And that's, you know, in some of the latest political bickering between the U.S. and the Russia, that's, you know, that's been the threat that we're going to, you know, stop talking. You know, the last thing in the world that you want to do in a crisis is to stop talking. So, you know, and as a matter of fact, you know, I guess about a year ago now, there was a directive from NASA to all the employees at NASA that you're not to speak to the Russians on anything except for operationally relevant things on the ISS. So I was like, okay. So, you know, obviously a knee-jerk reaction to some political issues. So there, you know, to this day, there's a lot of things that we have to overcome. But if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to put the work in, then the what comes out the other side is very, very worthwhile and makes the world a safer and more prosperous and equitable place. So.
You said that right now we're not using our resources well and we're not living sustainably. And you also talked about the triple bottom line, which is the economy and the society and also our resources. And you said that this problem could be fixed if we think about the triple bottom line in a different way, if we think about the planet supporting our economy and our society rather than our economy supporting our society and the planet. How would this help us, if everybody thought this way, how would this help us allocate our resources more efficiently so that they don't eventually run out?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I think the part of the answer to that is our shift in mindset. So we've come a long way in the last few decades. We've come, you know, if, you know, not, it wasn't that long ago that we didn't even have sustainability departments or corporate social responsibility departments. It's kind of a new phenomena, at least in most companies. But we haven't gone far enough, and the fact that we have, you know, the Department of Sustainability in a corporation or the Corporate Social Responsibility Department, and we put them in a stovepipe, as opposed to infusing that in the DNA of a company. I keep bringing up companies because companies have the biggest or one of the biggest impacts on the environment is the production of goods and services that come from the resources, including energy, in all the various forms of energy. And so when we change the mindset and we put those priorities different, and we talked about how they're nested, right? And that the economy is the wholly owned subsidiary of the environment, and the society is the intermediary there. When you treat your business decisions or your political decisions with that reality, that truth, then things become clear and the decision-making process is a little bit more leaning towards a sustainable approach. So I guess it boils down to, you know, instead of giving lip service to these things, we include it in you know, the very bottom line of what we're doing. And again, I don't think that, you know, I think the successful companies and political systems of the future are going to be those that have that mindset because we are empowered as citizens, as a public, to hold corporations and hold political systems accountable, so more and more. So,
our thanks again to Ron Guerin. Please join me.
Thank you very much.
This is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. This meeting is now adjourned.